This is Mad Mike. I guess I'm the guy y'all all scared of and shit. When you come to visit Detroit, boom, motherfucker, boom.
Hello and welcome to the Future Urbanism Podcast, Season 1, Episode 3, hosted by myself, Neil Slotnick, aka Future Urbanism. Before we start, just a very quick one to say thank you so much for the really positive feedback for the first two episodes, and apologies for the first 5 minutes of Episode 2, which ironically was on sound in warfare, and it actually sounded like I was in a warfare-type situation while recording the sound, so apologies for that. Now, this episode is titled Politics, Power and Techno, Underground Resistance. What we're going to do tonight, we're going to have a discussion on the Detroit Techno Electro Collective Underground Resistance. It's going to be just me. And I suppose really quite a pertinent time to be talking about underground resistance in Detroit, given what's happening in the United States all over. And what's going on with George Floyd. You know, listening to a lot of podcasts today, there's a lot of statements on George Floyd. I don't feel in a position to make a statement. I'm just a guy. I live in kind of the London, Essex area. I have my views, but I don't feel that really I can add anything to the discussion by kind of coming out with a real verbose statement. As a mark of respect to George Floyd and to every other victim of state, of federal, of government, of whoever sanctioned killing, we're going to keep this episode music free. The only thing I want to say is that, and it was said a few days ago, when your president says when there's time for looting, there's time for shooting, all you can do is look deep inside yourself and wonder where the world has gone. Now, to me, politics, music, conflict all go hand in hand. You know, you go way back in time. Actually, go back to the last episode, the Amazonian death whistle. You know, we're kind of bringing about music and tones into conflict. You think about kind of the Irish rebels, so much music linking in to kind of the political situation. But just to kick things off, really great article. If you want to get your head around music and politics, there's lonelytable.net, introductory kind of text by Lexi Morvaridi, just entitled Music and Politics. And she says the relationship between music and politics tends to be defined by the politics of resistance. And that brings us around nicely to Underground Resistance, famed for Detroit Techno, the godfathers of Detroit Techno Electro, established in 1989 by three artists, Mad Mike Banks, Jeff Mills, and Robert Hood. Now, Underground Resistance was really all about the kind of the aesthetics of early Detroit techno, kind of linking it up to social, political, economic circumstances, which followed on from that Reagan era inner city, kind of the policies, economic recession. And their music was uncompromising. It was geared towards promoting awareness. It was about facilitating political change. And the idea is that Underground Resistance's tracks created a sense of self-exploration, experimentation, and the ability to change yourself and your circumstances. You felt empowered by the music. A track called Transition, released in 2000, and Fire by Galaxy to Galaxy, absolutely killer track. I think it's number 2 on their self-titled album. And just that kind of, some of the lyrics that come through, just point yourself in the direction of your dreams, find your strength in the sound, and make your transition. Very pertinent words. The early UR Underground Resistance sound was defined by a kind of a real combo of like Motown, Chicago, soul. We got brutal techno coming through, acid. We got electro sounds in there as well. Kind of science fiction music. I mean, when I started listening to this stuff, and just to preface this, in 1989, I was 9. So I wasn't particularly listening to that when I wasn't even 10. I probably got into this sound kind of when I was 18, 19, started off with one of the mix CDs, I think it was the Aztec Mystic by Rolando, and just the tracks on that took me somewhere else. you know, Jeff Mills' background was in kind of Chicago industrial banks. Mad Mike Banks was kind of a jobbing musician, jobbing drummer, and Robert Hood, but also Mike Banks coming from a really solid house and techno base. And much of the early output on the label was kind of Banks, Mills, Hood, both solo in combination. They might swap in, they might swap out, but that sound really evolved and it morphed into electro, purist Detroit techno, and the members amassed, and I'm going to name check as many members as I can in a minute, just because even the names are absolutely fantastic. Now, if you've listened to any of my podcast output before, you might know that I'm a man that likes a bit of a list, the whole thing of number stations. I like number stations episode one for the regularity and the listiness of it. So I'm going to just give probably about 2-3 minutes now of name checks for Underground Resistance. I suppose really, I mean, as I said before, I like the names, but you know, if you're listening to this, you've never heard about Underground Resistance before, stick any of these names into your search engine and, you know, just take a listen to what's coming out. And obviously, if you like the sound, go out, find their stuff, get it on vinyl, support your local record shops, okay? So here we go then. Underground Resistance members are as follows: Mad Mike Banks, Agent Chaos, DJ Roach, Andre Holland, Billy Bob, Chuck Gibson, Cornelius Harris, Dan Caballero, DJ Buzz Gore, Frankie Gaultz, Galaxy to Galaxy, Gerald Mitchell, Ghetto Tech, ISH, James Pennington, Mark Floyd, Mark Flash, Mark Taylor, Mike Clark, Milton Baldwin, Raphael Merriweathers Jr., Esquared, Santiago Salazar, Timeline. We've had Jeff Mills, Claude Young, Robert Hood, Gerald Donald, James Stinson, who obviously made up Drexia, DJ Rolando. Have I said DJ Rolando before? I might have done. Anyway, I put him back in there. James Pennington, The Suburban Knight, Blake Baxter, Chuck Gibson, aka Perception and High Tech Funk, DJ 3000, DJ Scourge, DJ Dex, DJ S2, who we've kind of previously mentioned, Santiago Salazar, Division, The Unknown Soldier, DJ Digital, Claude Young, I think we've mentioned him before, Galaxy to Galaxy, yep, and The Martian. And also we have to reference Abu Kadim Haq, the cover sleeve artist, the kind of the inlay on vinyl artist, the creator, the artist of the Drexian mythology, which is out now. It's kind of a, we can call it a comic book, a graphic novel. It's out on Treasure right now. So for a collective established in 1989 with a lot of comings and goings, why Underground Resistance so relevant today? Why are they so relevant in times like these, incendiary times? Why are they so relevant politically? Well, Underground Resistance, and we'll discuss this as we go through, they are political, okay? And what one of their initial objectives was to provide alternative identities to inner city African American youth, other than that hyper masculine, hard and violent identities that were prevalent in those kind of late 80s, early 90s city living. Another form of the way that they rebel when they keep like music political is their rejection of the commercialization of techno. And you know, I'll talk about my record collection in a bit, I won't get too self-indulgent, but if you look at the messages kind of scratched into the UR vinyl, maybe, you know, the kind of mastering laboratory, if you listen to the lyrics, you listen to the sounds, everything is about message to the majors. We do not want to be linking up with you. So it's all about independence from these major record labels. Now, early on, Underground Resistance were called the public enemy of techno. There were views that this kind of militant perspective towards music could be really like linked up to public enemy, you know, fight the power, things like that. And also was being linked to the activities of the Black Panthers in the 1970s. And Jeff Mills, in a 2006 interview, responded to that claim to kind of the UR being the techno public enemy and those public... and those Black Panthers links. I'm just going to quote this verbatim. Mills said, "All the black men you see in America today are the direct result of those actions. All the freedoms we have, as well as the restrictions, refer back to the government and the Black Panthers in the 1970s. He continues, "So we make music. We make music about who we are and where we're from. Of course there's going to be links. That's why we had songs with titles like Riot, because that's indicative of the era we were born in and the things that we remember. As time goes on, naturally, I think the messages will get further away from that. It's not a coincidence. There is a reason behind You Are and Public Enemy and These People. And I've quoted that from an article by Andre Bergen in the Daily Yomiuri, a Japanese, I think, newspaper. And it was titled Jeff Mills Does Solo Flight, written in 2006. Now, for me, I'm very much distanced from America, pretty much 6 hours over the pond. I saw Underground Resistance and the kind of, I've seen a lot of their DJs play independently at clubs, and I keep talking about this one, clubs at like the End. I've seen them down at Fabric and some kind of smaller nights. I think down at the Egg, if people know that, around King's Cross. But I saw Underground Resistance as a collective at Mass in Brixton in 2001. And I referenced this in a previous podcast for a good friend of mine, Steve Nussbaum, on his Fantastical podcast. The room that they played in was black. It was blacked out. There was one blue strobe. And there were just guys there in balaclavas wearing military fatigues, carrying fake guns, real guns, I don't know, total militancy. And it was just, you know, driving techno. What a night. And, you know, I saw these guys in 2001. I was an early 20-something. I was living, again, I'd just come back from Cardiff University. I was living, again, on the London-Essex borders. And I had no knowledge of the politicization and what they really stood for. My life was just living in the suburbs, you know, but it was from there that I started collecting their vinyl, their 12 inches, their 7 inches, their mix CDs, you name it, I had it. And my record collection today, the Underground Resistance, the Red Planet, so many kind of sub-labels as well and related labels, has absolute prized position. So if this podcast is going to be about kind of Underground Resistance and power, I'm just going to really talk through kind of two articles that I think are absolutely fantastic, and I put them in the show notes. The first article that I really like, it was written in Vulture, and it really links Underground Resistance to the notion of power. The general suggestion in the article was that Underground Resistance as a collective wanted to go it alone. They did not want to release on any other label, and they wanted to control the molds of production and creativity. So for that purpose, they established Submerge, a distribution company, which, you know, it put out Underground Resistance tracks, but it put out much of the last quarter century of Detroit's greatest independent dance labels. You know, you could have some house in there, Chicago House, you could have your techno, your electro, your dub techno, all that kind of stuff. Submerge, now, this is one of what a few things in life I really regret. As I said, again, in that fantastic, I didn't go to Nebworth in 1996 to see the Prodigy and Oasis. My bigger regret was that I never actually got out to Detroit to go to the Submerge record store. The original Submerge record store was at 2030 Grand River, and it was indeed demolished by the city of Detroit. It was famous for being appointment only. It was vacated in the early part of the 2000s, and they moved to 3000 East Grand Boulevard. But, you know, from looking at this place on YouTube videos, from looking at pictures, you know, two things that stick out for me, obviously, and this is referenced in the article as well, there were certain records you could only buy within the Submerge record store, and you had that signature wall which contained every single legend of Detroit techno. Referencing the kind of maintenance of control of distribution, we've got a great quote by Cornelius Harris. Now, he joined Underground Resistance in the mid-90s, and he wrote a lot of the kind of verses of some of the more lyrical music. But again, I'm going to quote Cornelius Harris verbatim from the article. He says, "The whole idea of controlling your distribution was key to the survival of Detroit as a musical force. A lot of times, the economic piece of it gets overlooked. People don't typically look at dance music as business. They think it's just a bunch of fun parties and whatnot. They don't understand how the economics of it empowers people, especially when there aren't a lot of other opportunities." And the imagery and the language of Underground Resistance also conveyed that kind of collectivist approach to techno, and that sending out the message to the majors. Members, and I referenced this before about the Mass gig that I saw, they performed in masks. There was very limited photography. And when older artists would leave for solo careers, new soldiers were brought in. And you've got DJ Dex, who joined in the third wave of members. And he calls Underground Resistance's take on techno blue-collar techno, and it was created for research and development purposes. Perhaps the biggest message to the majors came in 1999 when DJ Rolando released a track called Jaguar on Underground Resistance, and it was also placed out on 430 West. Now, this was, I suppose, do we want to call it a crossover hit? You know, I don't know. Make it up what you will. Have a little YouTube. Go and buy it on vinyl. It did well. You know, you could hear it on the dance floors of Ibiza just as much as you could do of London and Detroit. Sony Germany, seemingly unaware of Underground Resistance's kind of views on corporate entities, attempted to license the track and were obviously rejected. You know, Underground Resistance had it out on their own channels. They bootlegged it as a cover version to great aplomb. Well, when I say great aplomb, it was pretty much an immediate cease and desist. And what that showed was obviously Underground Resistance maintaining that power, maintaining that almost anonymous identity and just keeping it real. The second and last article I want to reference is a title, Dream Deferred, by Martin Smith, written in 2014. And this article kind of gives a bit of a history of Detroit. It links it to Underground Resistance and Mad Mike Banks. But before we start there, you know, I did reference this on my first podcast. I'm a teacher of economics and business. And when I teach economic competitiveness, which is a part of the syllabus that I teach for economics, I will always show my students a video that was released on Journeyman TV. So it's available on YouTube. It's called Detroit America's War Zone. And it really is like a potted history. It's only 20 minutes long, a potted history of the decline of Detroit. And we're talking about, you know, the US auto industry pulling itself out, going across to Canada, going elsewhere, the kind of influence of the unions. And it paints quite a sad picture, but it also provides a message of hope. And I don't remember the names of the two academics that they interviewed. Again, if you watch this, you can have a look. It's about halfway through, but they are lecturers in urban planning, and what they talk about is actually a renewal of Detroit via city farms as an idea. Now, obviously, this was I think that the documentary was recorded some time ago. I'm very much doubting that Detroit is now full of city farms, but as an idea, I thought that was absolutely fantastic, and certainly the students are captivated by the video. If we turn to the content of Martin Smith's article, he says that Detroit is like Narva City on Earth. From 1900 to the 1960s, it was one of the main centers of US capitalism. It was obviously the heart of the US auto industry. It had wide boulevards, beautiful sculpture buildings, and lovely department stores. When Henry Ford offered the $5 a day to come and work in his Detroit car plants in 1914, it was a city of dreams for black and for white workers alike. Obviously, we then saw the collapse of the car industry, and then we saw unprecedented white flight. We then saw deindustrialization and poverty on an unprecedented scale. And that Detroit America's War Zone documentary really brings that view to life. At its height, there were 1.8 million people living in the city. Today, less than 700,000. And there is estimations that nearly a third of the city's 140 square miles now lie vacant. The last statistic that's pointed out, in 2010, one in four Detroiters lived below the federal poverty line. The black population now accounts for more than four in every five Detroit residents. Mike Banks's response to those statistics was as simple as this: Detroit has been left to rot, and it has everything to do with racism. Do you think they would let this happen to Manhattan? But out of this adversity, we're creating something pure, something good, and something uplifting. We are bringing back pride to ourselves and our city. We're going to leave this episode of the podcast there. I want to leave you with a kind of final quote. This was an interview with James Stinson, who was one half of Drexia. In a future episodes, I really want to take a deeper look into that kind of Drexian mythology. I strongly urge you to go out. This Spotify playlist, this stuff is all over. Listen to Drexia. You know, yeah, I don't even know what to say about the music. I think words can't really describe it. But I want to leave with a bit of positivity in what is a very non-positive world at the moment. And James Stinson was asked about this whole Drexian mythology and why he would often title his tracks with kind of an aquatic theme. And I'll just read this verbatim and then that'll be it for today. His response was, "The reason why we give a lot of our tracks aquatic titles is because waves are constantly changing. It moves in so many different directions. And that's the way we see our music. It doesn't go straight forward. It takes you on an adventure, constantly moving every which way. We record all our stuff live. You've got to capture that moment, that spirit, that energy. We could never recreate one of our records. It's impossible. Every Drexia record is different. They put you in a different mind space, give you different moods. We're dealing with your personality, your emotions. We try to get you to open your mind up and listen to the sounds. And hopefully then you can paint a picture in your mind. That's what it's all about."